DW, World in Progress. With Sarah Steffen.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Sarah Steffen. As more than 1 million people are leaving their homes in the US to escape Hurricane Florence, we take a look at disasters and disaster preparedness around the globe.
There was no power, there was no lights, there was no water, there was no cell service. It was a challenge.
And we also take a look at what you can do to prepare yourself ahead of disasters.
I have also here a solid and wind-up torch. This one can work at any place, any time, just by winding the handle, and you don't have to worry about whether or not you've got the batteries charged. I used that one during the Christchurch earthquake to listen to the radio immediately afterwards when the power was off.
Join me for a special episode right here on DW's World in Progress. In the US, over 1 million people have been ordered to leave their homes as Hurricane Florence approaches the southeast. It's the most powerful storm to threaten the states of North and South Carolina in almost three decades. According to the National Hurricane Center, the Category 4 storm is expected to hit the coast on Friday. It's the second highest hurricane category. About a year ago, Hurricane Irma, also a Category 4 storm, had devastated the Florida Keys, which are still struggling to rebuild. Hurricane Harvey hit the Texan coast in August last year with the same intensity. How are communities doing now, 1 year after the hurricane hit? The Texan town of Rockport is slowly returning to a sense of normal, but the trauma lives on, as Sertan Sanderson reports.
There was no power, there was no lights, there was no water, there was no cell service. It was a challenge.
Dave DeBoo vividly remembers the extent of the damage he encountered in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. The retired IT manager recounts blocked roads full of debris, houses that were demolished beyond recognition, boats stranded miles away from the water on the side of highways, and cars crushed into flat pieces under the weight of entire roofs and garage doors. But Dave DeBoo was not one of the thousands of residents of Rockport who were affected by the storm. He was one of the many volunteers who came to the coastal town from far and wide to help with the recovery efforts. The first response of volunteers in the wake of Hurricane Harvey played a pivotal role in Rockport's quick recovery. The picturesque small town on the Gulf Coast of Texas is a popular fishing village and bird-watching haven, attracting many people from across the US to spend their golden years here. In less than 12 months, the city has managed to clean up more than 2 million cubic yards of debris, which according to Rockport Mayor Pat Rios would not have been possible without the help of volunteers. Mayor Rios himself came out of retirement to support his community as it rebuilds.
Virtually every building in the city of Rockport was affected. Without those folks, we wouldn't see as quick an impact on our rebuild process because they bring manpower, they bring money, and they bring material with them. We've had thousands of volunteers that have brought in millions of dollars, different organizations.
Elon Kalman, a researcher in risk resilience and global health at the University College London, believes that anyone anywhere can be hit by disasters at any given time, and that the very idea of safety merely is an illusion.
We absolutely know 100% a disaster will hit all locations at some point in time. Disasters are not caused by the weather. They are not caused by the hurricane. Disasters are caused by where we live, how we allocate resources, how we deal with people, what sort of society we want.
But some people might be better prepared for such disasters, or weather, than others. They might have better resources in place or have experience in dealing with past catastrophes. Others might be caught off guard, having to jump into motion on extremely short notice. One of those taken by surprise about the extent of all the repercussions of a hurricane is Luis Perron, executive director of the Rockport Arts Center. Having never witnessed a hurricane before, Perron found himself having to mobilize all his resources to protect his museum less than 2 days before Harvey made landfall.
This experience of having gone through this hurricane has really matured me tremendously. We took all of the art and concentrated it in a safe place and covered it in the center of the building where we thought the least damage would be were this to turn into a Category 4 storm, which is what eventually happened.
Most of the artwork shown in the museum's permanent display survived the storm, and some pieces were later restored. However, the building itself had to be bulldozed, and most of the artworks shown in the members' gallery were lost to the hurricane. For now, the well-known Rockport Arts Center is housed in two adjacent buildings that survived the storm, not far from its original site, thanks to all members of the community supporting each other in the recovery efforts, and Luis Perón's tenacity in making sure that Rockport's art scene stays alive.
People came together, they just pulled their boots up, and everybody just went to work. And the town is really doing really, really well. And we are, you know, many of the businesses have reopened, including the Arts Center. We reopened 99 days later after the hurricane. This is still a beautiful place. There's still, the water's still beautiful. The trees have come back. The birds are back. The light is still luminescent as it always was. So we all have a lot of hope for Rockport.
The story of Rockport's recovery is one of outstanding community spirit that has reverberated throughout the state of Texas and beyond. But it is also a cautionary tale, according to disaster expert Ilan Kalman, especially with hurricane patterns believed to be changing because of global warming.
Climate change is projected to decrease frequency, but increase intensity. This means likely fewer hurricanes, which are a lot more powerful and drop a lot more rain. The time to start preparing is now. If you live along the Gulf Coast of the U.S., if you live along the Atlantic Coast of the U.S., forget about Harvey, Katrina, and past storms. Prepare for a Category 5 hurricane starting now.
Sertan Sanderson, Rockport, Texas.
Preparing for hurricanes and also for earthquakes as they unleash equally destructive forces. Just take the Italian town of Amatrice that was hit by a powerful earthquake over 2 years ago. Most of its city center had been destroyed. How are citizens faring today? Lisa Weiss paid Amatrice a visit, and her report is presented by Natalie Mala.
Siamo nel cuore del centro storico di Amatrice.
We're in the heart of Amatrice's historical center. Let's go. I'll take you to my house, or what's left of it.
Perché è rimasto di casa mia.
Sergio Serafini stands in the middle of what's known as the Red Zone and looks out over the vast debris fields. He works at the Amatrice Town Hall. It's hard to get your bearings here. Where alleys and houses once stood, there are now only ruins. Even 2 years on from the first of the devastating earthquakes to strike the city, Serafini points to a small tree growing atop a pile of rubble. This is where his house stood, he says, until the quake struck.
The wall collapsed. Luckily, the roof held. But the wall fell on top of me. I couldn't move at all. My brother freed me after about an hour, at 4:30.
Dopo un'ora, alle 4:30.
For those living here, those who lost their loved ones, going to the scene of devastation that used to be the old center is still unbearable, says Serafini. Access to the area is restricted anyway. You're only allowed in with special permission, and you have to wear a helmet and safety shoes. The Italian military guards the entrance. Excavators here are working to clear debris. Six people stand before a conveyor belt, sorting the rubble from raw materials. It's hard to believe the earthquake happened over 2 years ago. Apart from the paved road that now runs through the red zone, little appears to have changed over the past year. Serafini believes that Amatrice will eventually be rebuilt. He says the place has become symbolic in a way, but there's still a lot of uncertainty.
Non lo sappiamo. Nessuno può dirlo, perché poi come...
We don't know yet, and no one can tell us how Amatrice will be rebuilt. Surely not everyone will be able to live there again, because I think the structures won't be built so high. But we just don't know, because there's been no discussion yet.
The sluggish progress is a problem for Amatrice. The town's economy depends on tourism. Many Italians had a holiday home here. But now that most of it is in ruins, they're spending their vacations elsewhere. A few kilometres away, in a crowded eatery in the Samati district, Nano Bonanni is glad to see us. We met during our last visit to the town a year ago. Back then, we found him sitting next to his ruined restaurant, homeless, dejected, and desperate.
Depresso, depresso. Invece quest'anno siamo ripartiti.
Exactly. I was depressed. This year, we picked ourselves up again, and we reopened on the 1st of May. The place is doing well. The state helped out, just a little, but we managed anyway.
Next to the old, damaged restaurant, there's now a big wooden house. It was built by the state, but the family had to pay for the kitchen, furnishings, and much more, says Bonanni's son, Angelo. The family forked out some 250,000 euros for it, but they believe it's all been for nothing because the state is adamant that the restaurant needs to be relocated soon.
Nonostante io investo dei soldi miei di tasca mia.
Although I'm investing my money, they only see it as a temporary structure. And even though the state has paid 500,000 euros for it, as soon as we can go back to our old restaurant, it will be demolished.
Questa struttura pagata dallo Stato quasi 500,000 euro.
Money down the drain, slow progress, assistance that isn't what people really need. According to the Bonannis, these are the big problems locals are grappling with.
Natalie Muller with that report by Lisa Weiss.
For more stories on globalisation and development, check out DW Global Society on Facebook and our TV show Global 3000 at dw.com/global3000.
Still to come, what you can do to be prepared in the event of a disaster.
And in here you'll see we've got some of my favourites. I like instant mashed potato because you can make it up with boiling water. But lots of fish. Don't forget your can opener. No good having a can without a can opener.
Stay tuned for that and more. Let's go to Chile now, that's situated on the Pacific Ring of Fire, a hotbed of earthquakes where tectonic plates rub up against each other. Chile is one of the most earthquake-prone countries in the world. The small town of De Shadow, located along the coast, was one of the towns that were almost completely destroyed by the 8.8 magnitude earthquake in 2010. The quake triggered a tsunami, killing more than 500 people. Today, 8 years later, most of the town has been rebuilt. But for the people here, life will never be the same. Sophia Boddenberg went to meet the residents, and her report is presented by Ineke Mules.
De Chato is a small coastal town located around 500 kilometers or about 310 miles south from Chile's capital, Santiago. Most of the 3,000 inhabitants here earn their livelihoods as fishermen or work in the local restaurants. In summer, thousands of tourists come to the town's beaches. But on the 27th of February 2010, the peaceful beach town was shocked by a major earthquake in the early morning hours.
The street lamps were moving like rubber bands from one side to the other. The road was moving. The people who were running tripped over the emerging humps. A family up the hill received us. Everyone went up the hills. No one stayed down here.
That Saturday night at 3:34 a.m. local time, the second most powerful earthquake in Chile's history shook the country, with a magnitude of 8.8, Antonio Alomar recalls. The earthquake triggered a tsunami which devastated several coastal towns. De Chato was among the worst hit places and was almost completely inundated. The epicenter of the quake was just 50 kilometers away from the town. Alomar is 62 and was born and raised in De Chato. He and his family used to live right next to the beach and owned a pub close by. They lost everything because of the quake. When the tsunami destroyed De Chato, Alomar was the head of the town's Chamber of Commerce and Tourism. He united all the small business people to rebuild a local business. Many of them didn't have insurance.
95% of the commerce of De Chato disappeared in that moment.
95% of De Chado's commerce disappeared at that moment. We got organized, got together to plan the reconstruction and to discuss the politics of the government. We worked hand in hand with the government and the authorities. Together we reconstructed De Chado.
In December 2012, Alomar opened a new restaurant called Asturias, right next to the beach. The seaside front was completely reconstructed. There's now a concrete promenade for tourists and the flood wall in front of the promenade. In February 2018, 8 years after the tsunami, the last part of the reconstruction project that had required an investment of over $20 million was completed.
Dichato is a different Dichato now. Before, it was more romantic. There were dirt roads. When I left my house, I just had to cross the street and was by a sandy beach. Today, there is a big investment in touristic infrastructure. People still come to visit the places affected by the earthquake, but Dichato is not the same anymore.
Little by little, tourists have come back to Dichato's beaches. But according to Alomar, commerce has only recovered by around 50%. Earth tremors are nothing out of the ordinary in Chile. In 2017, the country recorded more than 8,000 tremors, according to the University of Chile, though none reached the magnitude of an earthquake. This is the alarm sound that is supposed to warn Chileans of tsunamis. But on the 27th of February 2010, it did not warn anyone. Investigations found enormous negligence in the procedure of the public agencies in charge of disasters. The alarm could have saved many lives, but since there was no alarm, people had no chance to evacuate their homes and villages in time. A number of things went wrong. First, the authorities did not pass on the tsunami alarm that the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii had sent them just 1 minute after the earthquake because the person in charge didn't speak English. Then, after the warning had gone out, the authorities called it off too early, and many Chileans went back to their homes, meeting death and destruction. The tsunami at Dichato consisted of 7 waves. Many people who had evacuated for the tsunami returned after the 5th wave, believing it was over, and were killed by the 6th wave. 16 people died in Dichato that day.
Today there are emergency escape routes. There are institutions that notify and inform. That day the firefighters told us to go up the hill, but today we are much better prepared.
A group that was particularly affected by the seaquake in Dichato were the local fishermen. One of the fishermen is Juan Letelier, also known as El Niño. He owns a small shop that is now close to the sea called Josefina, where he sells food and drinks. He says that he didn't get any help from the government to rebuild his home.
I lost everything. After 2 years, I went back fishing. Meanwhile, I reconstructed my house with my own resources, with my wife. I didn't get any help from the government. When I had rebuilt my boat, a second earthquake destroyed it again.
Just 1 year after the tsunami, in April of 2011, the most powerful earthquake ever recorded in Japan triggered tsunami waves that also reached the Chilean coast and damaged Dichato once again. Close to El Niño's house, several fishermen pull up a small boat on the shore. An old man with a white beard and lots of wrinkles is sitting in his favourite chair close by watching the sea. Luisberto Mendez, or Huetito, as everyone around here calls him, has experienced 3 seaquakes in Dichato. The first one was in 1960, the strongest earthquake recorded in the 20th century. But the tsunami of 2010 was one that was much worse for people in Dichato.
That day, I wanted to go out fishing. I got up at 4 a.m., put on my clothes, and had a coffee. I couldn't believe it. I went outside, and all my neighbors were outside. I said to them, "Get your children and run up the hill." They asked me why. I had experienced the quake of 1960, so I knew the water wasn't going to rise straight away. It would take 10 to 15 minutes. I told everyone to go up the hill, and then the sea came in. There weren't waves. The sea just filled up the cove, and it took everything. Everything here was underwater. It was very sad.
Juan Huetito is a member of the fishermen's syndicate. Like him, all 120 fishermen in Dichato lost everything because of the quake. The majority didn't receive help from the government to rebuild their homes and repair the boats after the tsunami. In 2016, the Supreme Court of Chile decided that the government had to pay over $1 billion in compensation to families of victims of the tsunami across the country because the alarm system malfunctioned. According to Huetito, the government's reparations weren't fair for everyone.
There are people who suffered, but many people took advantage. There are people who didn't lose anything, and they wrote their names down and were the first ones to get a new house. I had inherited my house from my parents, and that's why I didn't get anything. They should have given me back my house, but I didn't receive anything up till today. I did everything on my own.
People in Dichato have suffered a lot, but they have developed a strong resilience to be able to go on with their lives.
That report by Sophia Boddenberg was presented by Ineke Mules. When a disaster strikes, it's usually in the headlines for a few days, and then people often forget about it again. But how do people living through a disaster cope with the aftermath? And what lessons do they take away? What lessons are there maybe for us to learn? David Killick was in Christchurch in New Zealand on February 22nd in 2011, when a disastrous magnitude 6.3 earthquake hit the city. 185 people were killed as the earthquake destroyed buildings in the city center and forced whole suburbs to be abandoned. Here's David Killick with a very personal story.
When the earthquake struck, I was in the city library. It was my lunch break. You're supposed to drop, cover and hold, but I didn't do that. I staggered across the bucking floor and braced myself against a concrete column. I figured if that collapsed, then there was no chance of surviving. After the shaking stopped, people silently walked downstairs. There was no mass panic. Everyone stayed calm. Most were too stunned to say anything. Once outside, I called my wife by cell phone and got through. She was fine. Soon, cell phone networks would overload, making communications difficult. Streets were a mess, dust everywhere, rubble all around, and sirens and alarms going off. The library, where I'd been, was a strong building, but the old historic press building, where I'd been working only a short time before, had been hit badly. The top floor had collapsed, trapping people inside. One woman was killed. Another lost both her legs. My colleagues were staggering out of the building in a state of shock. I walked home past collapsed buildings through crowded streets. It took about an hour. Our house was still standing, but doors were warped and stuff had been flung across the rooms. We had no electricity or running water. Living without power isn't too bad, but water is vital. Luckily, we were prepared. We had bottled water, flashlights, a gas camp stove, and a solar camp shower we could hook up. We couldn't get TV or the internet, but had a battery-powered transistor radio to listen to the news. We got power back after a few days. Water took about a week. In the meantime, water was trucked in, and we could also visit a local well. Rebuilding Christchurch's shattered water and sewage system took years. Today, while it's not compulsory, just about every house has an emergency kit. Claire Shave, who's worked for the Red Cross in disaster areas around the world and who lives in Christchurch, says the most important item is water.
You need at least as much for 3 days. I've got more downstairs. I keep it in different places around the house just in case I can't get to where it is. Most important item. Then after that, we've got food. And in here, you'll see we've got some of my favourites. I like instant mashed potato because you can make it up with boiling water. But lots of fish. Don't forget your can opener. No good having a can without a can opener. Then we're going on from here. We have household items. Now, you'll see that everything's in plastic bags. That's very important in case anything gets wet. So my tissues, my toilet paper, my tea towel, plastic bags. I have candles, they're not recommended if there's any risk of gas. But Dettol, hand sanitizer, that sort of thing. Now, my personal favorite here happens to be the clean sacks. These are plastic rubbish bags. What I do with these is I line the toilet with two, and each day I take away one of these and remove it somewhere where it doesn't contaminate anything.
Claire says it's also important to have a small backpack ready in case you need to evacuate quickly. And since telecommunication systems might be down, you need to be prepared for that as well, she says.
So the first item here is notebooks and pens, because you often need to leave a message saying where you've gone and put it in your letterbox on the way out. Everyone knows the importance of torches with batteries and a battery charger. I have also here a solid and wind-up torch. This one can work in any place, any time, just by winding the handle, and you don't have to worry about whether or not you've got the batteries charged. I used that one during the Christchurch earthquake to listen to the radio immediately afterwards when the power was off.
And then, of course, it's a good idea to have a first aid kit ready, some medication, as well as sunscreen and insect repellent, and spare clothes. When the devastating earthquake hit in February, most old historic buildings built out of stone or unreinforced masonry collapsed or were damaged beyond repair. These included the iconic Anglican and Catholic cathedrals. However, the biggest loss of life, 115 people, including many overseas language students, occurred in the much newer multi-story CTV building, which collapsed. The reason was poor design, but despite an inquiry, the engineers responsible were never prosecuted. The central city was closed off for well over a year, with cordons controlled by the army, while buildings were demolished and streets made safe. The city was still dangerous, as over 10,000 aftershocks persisted for over a year. Building back has been the biggest challenge in Christchurch. Some low-lying areas of the city suffered from liquefaction. The ground bubbled up, making a hell of a mess and causing houses to sink. Those areas were red-zoned and had to be abandoned. People got paid out by the government, but the move was controversial, as relocating was costly and difficult, and not everyone wanted to move. It took years to get our house properly repaired. Christchurch still hasn't been completely rebuilt. The government-funded Earthquake Commission had never anticipated a disaster on this scale and was widely criticised for its sometimes haphazard approach. So were insurance companies. Some people are still fighting to get claims settled. One good thing is that new buildings have been designed to be as earthquake-proof as possible. As retired University of Canterbury engineering professor Andy Buchanan, who helped pioneer a resilient form of wooden building technology, explains.
The old unreinforced masonry buildings largely fell over. The big concrete buildings were damaged and often so badly they had to be demolished. But the lightweight buildings, mostly made of steel and wood, they survived very well and they're still there.
How are we building now that's different?
So what we're doing now that's different is we are not replacing the concrete buildings with the old-style reinforced concrete buildings. And most of the new buildings in Christchurch are steel. And if you drive through the city, you see they've got diagonal braces everywhere. As well as the vertical columns and horizontal beams, they're crisscrossed with diagonal braces so that they won't move so much in future earthquakes.
Nobody can predict when the next earthquake will happen. Maybe soon, maybe not for years. Perhaps the main lesson I've learnt, be practical, be prepared, get an emergency kit, get to know your neighbours, and make sure your home and your workplace are as safe as possible. David Killick, DW, Christchurch, New Zealand.
And that's all the time we had today. For more World in Progress episodes, go to dw.com/worldinprogress. Thanks very much from all of us in the studio, Celestine Vazike, Gerd Georgi, Leon Nowak, and me, Sarah Steffen. Bye for now.